Hi, this is Jimmy Bucciolato with the Original Gangsters podcast. I'm in studio, and my co-conspirator, Scott Bernstein, is not here in the studio with us, but he is an investigative reporter extraordinaire. He is in the field breaking his next big story, and he's kind enough to call in. So we're going to have a little bit different approach today. But Bernie, you out there?
Yeah, I'm out here from an undisclosed location. I am planting seeds that will hopefully soon bloom into a great, you know, a great story that I'm known for.
Yeah, you're the man, intrepid journalist out there.
Yeah, in all sincerity, we're just, you know, some logistics made it so we had to kind of have me call in, and I'm excited about the topic today. So let's talk about O.J. Simpson and the Mafia.
Yeah, so you broke a story not long ago on Gangster Report. By the way, people, check out Gangster Report. You're probably familiar with it, but that's Scott's online magazine. And it's the Big Tuna theory. Was O.J. murder case actually a mafia hit? And I think this is a really interesting story. And let's start with the crime.
Let's also just start by giving people context.
Yes.
That while for a good 35 years, O.J. Simpson had this veneer of being this very benign, jovial, perfectly crafted pitchman for corporate America, while also being, you know, one of the greatest professional football players the league had ever seen. I mean, he took the NFL by storm in the 70s when he came out of USC. But almost from day one in his NFL career, he was haunted or shadowed, if you will, by rumors of mafia connections. And these connections follow him to this day. And I am pretty confident in the assertion that this isn't public knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to...
That should be our starting point.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to one of the staff people here in the studios and talking about when I was a teenager in college and this story broke about the murder of his ex-wife and her friend. I was naive. I didn't know any of those things that Scott just talked about. I thought, oh, this is O.J. He was a great football player. He's a broadcaster on NBC. There's no way O.J., America's sweetheart, would have anything to do with a double homicide. So I was one of those people that was naive and had no idea that O.J. had this, not only in terms of abusing his wife, but like these other sketchy elements of his life, criminal associates, maybe ties to the mob. So to Scott's point, I mean, I think O.J. did a pretty good job of like selling this wholesome image of like the all-American good guy athlete / actor.
And in fact, you know, when you do a deep dive into his files in the offices of the DEA, FBI, LA Police Department, Buffalo Police Department, you find that he was, and let's not forget South Florida, where he also came under investigation. He was if not the subject, he was a target in one way or another in close to a half a dozen different criminal probes by different criminal probes by different law enforcement organizations.
So what about, let's start with in the beginning, like him growing up in Oakland, did he have a reputation as like a street guy there? Like, I mean, not an organized criminal,
no.
But was he running with gangs or anything like that?
No, I don't think he did at all.
Okay. So this might have started in Buffalo, then not like at USC or anything like that.
I don't know. I mean, he was in L.A. in the late 60s, and he was a celebrity. And if you know anything about O.J. Simpson, you know that he's like a moth to a flame when it comes to cameras and attention and media glitz and glamour. I mean, even today. Just check out his social media posts. So I wouldn't be shocked if he rubbed some elbows back in college, but I think the first time he popped up on the FBI's radar, the early days of the DEA, Buffalo Police Department. I should say the first time he popped up on the radar of law enforcement was when he was selected by the Buffalo Bills, became a all-pro NFL running back, broke a lot of records, ran for a lot of yards, ran for a lot of touchdowns, but also was running in a really fast crowd in the early to mid-70s in Buffalo. And that crowd was, without question, people in that crowd, without question, were connected to organized crime and the Magdaleno crime family. He not only was he either the subject or was if you were going to be liberal, would say an ancillary figure or, you know, any form of target, whether he was the number one target or the number 20 target in a conspiracy investigation. It's undisputed that, you know, he came really close a couple times to major embarrassment. The first thing that comes to mind is the fact that the feds raided his house in 2001, looking into an ecstasy ring, or looking into his possible involvement in an ecstasy ring. And they didn't find anything. But again, when the feds are raiding your house with a search warrant, you're dancing with the devil, if you will, or you're definitely playing with fire. And then back in the 70s, there was a pretty infamous raid of a after-hours party in Buffalo, where Buffalo police and the New York State police raided this party where there was a lot of celebrities and gangsters and athletes. And OJ and one of his best friends, who was a very high-profile figure, someone that the feds insisted was a mafia-backed drug dealer, but they were never able to convict him of being that, Mike Militello. Militello and OJ left the party like 2 minutes or 3 minutes before the police hit the door.
Was that a coincidence, or were they tipped off, or we don't know?
You know, those are other questions about, okay, you know, whether or not they were getting, you know, insider tips or whatnot. But, and then back in the 90s, when before the incident that we're about to go into, which was the murders of his ex-wife or soon to be ex-wife, and a young waiter friend of hers that just happened to probably be in the wrong place at the wrong time, Ron Goldman, that LAPD and the FBI in LA were investigating him for bookmaking and brokering drug deals, and some capacity loan sharking. And the person they were investigating him, the person they were investigating alongside OJ was Bob Kardashian. And again, this isn't speculation. This is well documented. Now, none of these cases did charges ever, surface. Was OJ ever, called to account for his alleged behavior? But he was definitely investigated quite thoroughly and quite consistently over the years before and after the Nicole Brown Simpson, Ron Goldman flame.
Let me ask you something, going back to the beginning here, the 70s, just for some context here. I wonder if this was a delicate political situation, because O.J. Simpson is prince of the city in Buffalo, popular athlete. And if federal law enforcement stumbles upon this, you know, reality that he hobnobs with gangsters, I wonder what, if there was any kind of like political pressure or something to like look the other way. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that could be, that could ruffle a lot of feathers in powerful, you know, Buffalo society, if that makes sense.
That goes to what you just referenced, the possibility of 2 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Was it a coincidence that Militello and Simpson left that party, you know, less than 5 minutes before there was this huge raid that made headlines, at least around the whole state of New York, if not around the country, and ended up in the and resulted in the arrest of a semi-prominent gangland figure that eventually was killed in a gangland style hit around the same time that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were killed. I'm blanking on how you say his last name, but he was, I'll pull it up in a second, but he was a guy that actually got arrested in that raid. And I know that he told people before he met his untimely demise that he believed that that whole situation was possibly a setup.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Let's be real here. Like, if OJ is the Prince of the City football player and he's hobnobbing with gangsters, we also know he's hobnobbing with, like, wealthy, influential business people, politicians, right? We know star athletes, that's who they rub elbows with as well. And so they're, I mean, let's not be naive about it. I'm just speculating, of course, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility that powerful interest would have, tried to persuade law enforcement to maybe back off or lay off someone who's that popular and important to the franchise.
The guy's name was Butch Casey, but his real name was Kazimir Strzarski, and he owned a number of clubs in Buffalo at that same time, along with Militello. And OJ frequented a lot of those clubs. Casey's Nickelodeon was Butch Casey's. Mulligan's was like the hottest spot in Western New York in the 70s. It was like, you know, Studio 54 in Buffalo. That was owned by Militello, who was a really intriguing character, kind of made for a Hollywood script. He was a Vietnam vet who was a war hero. Really good looking guy, really smart businessman, went in and helped build what was the high flying 1970s disco social scene in Buffalo. Militello owned a bunch of clubs. The feds believed that he was supplying cocaine into that scene. Again, they were never able to, I don't believe they ever charged him, but they definitely were never able to convict him. They thought OJ was brokering deals between Militello and athletes in Buffalo that were buying either wholesale or semi-wholesale cocaine. Not wholesale, but buying in bulk, where they didn't have to buy eight balls every night. So Militello was definitely on the Fed's radar, and the fact that he was running around with Simpson kind of even upped the ante even more. OJ was best man at Militello's wedding. And again, Militello owned clubs, owned restaurants. And then he was kind of like the heterosexual version of Steve Rubell, who was the kind of the ringmaster of Studio 54 in New York City. Mike Militello was kind of his counterpart in Western New York, in Buffalo. He was kind of the one that was his places, whatever places he owned were the places to be, where the rich and famous went and hung out. Any celebrities that were in Buffalo, whether athletes coming to play the Bills or entertainers coming to perform, they'd always end up at Militello's restaurants and clubs and eventually at a lot of his after hours parties. So Militello is a really interesting character, and that was OJ's best friend when he was in Buffalo. So like I said, from very early on, OJ was in the crosshairs of law enforcement.
And this Militello, was he, I'm sorry, I missed it. Did you say, we don't know if he was a made guy or not, or he wasn't a made guy?
I don't believe they ever thought he was a made guy.
Okay.
I think they thought he was an associate.
Okay.
And an alleged drug supply chain into La Cosa Nostra in the Nagadino crime family.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get to the murders, let's fast forward to the 90s when you say that OJ was also suspected of being involved in organized criminal activities, because that to me is really intriguing, because if you look at the investigations in the 2000s, someone who's an apologist for OJ might say, well, listen, federal law enforcement had a hard on for him, so they're just going to manufacture stuff and any excuse to go after him because they feel like he literally got away with murder and whatever. I mean, you could imagine someone saying that. But in the 90s, if they're investigating this, there's no axe to grind, right, by law enforcement at that point with OJ. In fact, it seems like he was on pretty good terms with law enforcement for the most part. So that's really intriguing to me that they were investigating him, you know?
No, I think there's some nuance to that.
Yeah.
He was on good terms with the LAPD or certain parts of the LAPD.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean he was on good terms with the FBI.
Sure.
Or DEA.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Right. So what was, can you unpack that a little bit more? That, I mean, that's really intriguing. Was that supposed to be something he was running on his own or connected to former NFL players, or was that connected to the Italians too?
No, I don't believe, well, at least from my limited research on the subject, I don't believe they thought that OJ was doing any or running any rackets on behalf of the LA Mafia in the 80s and 90s. But they did believe that he was booking bets for celebrity friends or brokering bets to bookmakers, who then, I guess you could say, those bookmakers were probably connected to the FBI.
Right, so right.
I guess, you know, you could say that there's the possibility that there was some mafia adjacent activity.
Yeah, indirectly.
Yeah. And that he was, again, brokering narcotic deals to his celebrity friends. And that plays into the theory that's coming out now about possible mob involvement in the Brown Simpson Goldman murders. And then the fact that the FBI believed, again, they never charged. So this is all parlor room cigar talk. because there were no charges, but
right.
You know that the FBI believed that Robert Kardashian was partners with OJ in some bookmaking activity, again brokering some of these drug deals, and then loaning out money.
Wow, I mean, it seems plausible in the sense that, like, wealthy people also buy drugs and place bets. And take out, you know, loans that that they can't get from a bank. So if they're interested in that, they're not going to, you know, some jabroni on the street, right? They're going to go to someone else who's wealthy and powerful who happens to have those kinds of connections. So I don't know if it's true, but I'm just saying the scenario seems plausible to me.
Right.
That Kardashian and OJ would have some, like, associates who were, unscrupulous.
And they were living a really fast lifestyle at that point. And I think there's been rumors that they were, you know, they were swinging.
Right.
That they would be exchanging partners. I know that's, you know, a little salacious, but I think OJ's actually spoken about it on record about how...
Yeah.
He had some type of romance with Mama Kardashian, Chris.
And by the way, just some shameless self-promotion here. In the early days of our podcast, we interviewed Dan Moldea, and we talked about specifically corruption in the NFL. And we talked about his book, Interference. And listeners want to dig into our archives and listen to that episode. And Moldea, yeah, he makes a pretty good case that some of these shenanigans are still going on with NFL players in terms of having connections to bookmakers and drug dealers and things like that. So my overall point is not only to shamelessly self-promote our podcast, but also to point out that this is not a wild speculative theory that an NFL player or a retired NFL player would have connections to the underworld. Would you agree?
Yes. I think people would be shocked. And not necessarily even major organized crime. I think there are all levels of organized crime and criminality that are on the edges or even maybe further infiltrated than the edges into college football, pro football, college basketball, pro basketball. I think if you realized who a lot of these people were socializing with off the court, it would give a lot of pause to people, especially when they would be looking at point spreads and how point spreads were did or didn't come in on certain games. I just think if there was ever any way to quantify it or any metric, it's impossible to do this. But if you could somehow come up with a number of how many games on a weekly basis are in some way manipulated point spread wise, I just think that people would be astounded. I think experts would be astounded.
Yeah, I mean, when we had our episode with Michael Francis, I mean, he broke that down for us. And we know that our episode, that got some pub on local sports radio here. And some of the local sports personalities were like, remember, they were like flabbergasted, like, no way, yeah. that can't be true. So I agree with you. I think some people are surprised and maybe even naive about these connections between athletes and criminal figures, underworld people. And to the extent that it may, right, that could affect the actual outcome of, it's one thing to just for OJ to be hanging out at a club with some wise guy or something, but what you're talking about is actually may actually impact the actual competition itself.
Yeah, and at least in OJ's day, the entire American gambling economy up until maybe 15 years ago was controlled by the mafia.
Right.
So anybody at any level of professional or high level college sports that was gambling, they were gambling with the mob, whether they knew it or not.
Yeah. No, I think I completely agree.
And now there are, like I said, there are different levels now. I mean, you don't have to, I'm not saying that people would be astounded by the number of games. I think that are in some way, shape or form, those games have point spread outcomes that are manipulated. I'm not saying that some Wizard of Oz mafia figure is in New York City, you know, behind the curtain puppeting all this.
Right.
You know, I'm saying, I think there are little pockets here and there of people that are no name criminals, not people that are completely off the police radar, that have access to athletes and access to knowledge, insider information. And in those little nooks and crannies, there's a lot of point spread manipulation, I believe.
Yeah, I think especially, I mean, Michael Francis talked to us about, like, especially college athletes are vulnerable, I should say, even, you know, far more so than professional athletes. Not to say it doesn't go on there, but
OJ, for, you know, no pun intended, was juiced in to the NFL. He was a broadcaster. He was Monday Night Football. Then he was on the NBC broadcast. I don't doubt that, you know, he was using information he could glean from his
sources in
the NFL to help him handicap. And if he was bookmaking to friends and certain, you know, ex-athletes or current athletes or actors and or singers or whatever, I'm sure that he was using his connections into the league to benefit him and his business. Alleged business.
Yeah, and this is more of a psychological profile. I don't know if this will interest our listeners, but OJ would strike me as the kind of dude that would be doing that, not as a, like to generate a revenue stream, but just a guy that liked to be the center of attention and liked to be a high roller and a big shot, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, I'm not even sure he was a gangster. I'm just saying he just strikes me as a dude that would like to be part of that atmosphere. Does that make sense?
No, he's an adrenaline addict, just right. Like so many professional athletes. And he's someone that, I don't want to say thrives, but or at least at the time, thrived in the fast lane.
Right.
It did him really well.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
It made him richer than many pro athletes could ever dream of. He used to tell people, I'm not black or white, I'm OJ.
Right. He
was one of the first African American corporate pitchmen to really cross over and connect with just so many mass consumers, and he had access to the highest levels in the entertainment industry, highest levels of professional sports. I mean, he was incredibly networked in, until his downfall. And even now, if you pay attention to him on social media or pay attention to the tabloids, he lives a fast life still. He's hanging out in strip clubs. He's right. Running around with gamblers and porn stars and ex-criminals or alleged current criminals. I mean, he still wants to be the center of attention. He just can't be the center of attention in the same way he was in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s.
And I think this is good context, especially for some of our younger listeners, because, guys our age and older, we remember all this, but younger listeners may not remember that OJ was, again, like America's darling, a corporate pitchman, an actor in TV and film. Yeah. And so to your point that this guy was tapped in.
Like Shaq or LeBron.
Right. That's a good, good comparison. He was like a really popular dude.
Peyton Manning.
Right. In all aspects of the entertainment industry, not just professional sports. So let's jump to the 90s and let's at least address the crimes at hand, and then we'll break down whether or not we think there was any organized crime angle to it. But I don't even remember what year was that. Was that 95?
It was early summer 94.
94. Okay.
Jimmy and I were both teenagers. At the time it was called the crime of the century. It really transformed the way that trials are covered in the media. The way that, the 24-hour news cycle was kind of started with the OJ case.
Yes, 100%.
And to do a 30-second synopsis, OJ Simpson had a very rocky marriage to Nicole Brown Simpson, who was the mother of of a number of his children. And the marriage was coming to an end in June 94. And they had gone to some family meal together, and there had been some verbal spat after one of their kids' soccer games or something. And OJ was supposed to leave for Chicago that night. And before he left, Nicole Brown Simpson and a waiter from the dinner that night named Ron Goldman were found butchered to death outside of Brown Simpson's residence. And they were both stabbed 40, 50 times apiece. And OJ went to Chicago, and when he came back into town, there was, quickly the belief that he might have had something to do with it. And I don't think he did anyone any favors with how he was interacting with law enforcement and being kind of too much of an open book early on in the investigation. And then a week or two later, there was a warrant issued for his arrest. He went on the run. It was nationally televised. Literally every news station in America, local, national, that night, I forgot what night it was, June something, 1994, turned to this, what was a slow speed chase.
The Bronco.
Of law enforcement. Yeah, it was him in a white Bronco and threatening to kill himself. And eventually they were able to calm him down and get him to turn himself in. They arrested him. He was charged. He went on trial. It was a three-ring circus of a trial. And at the end of the day, he was acquitted and walked free. But then a couple years later, he would be found liable in civil court for the death of Brown Simpson and Goldman. And then about 10 years later, he was arrested for an armed robbery that he committed in Las Vegas, where he went to go take back what he thought was sports memorabilia that had been taken from him, or he believed had been taken from him. He went and brought a gun and some associates, and they stormed into a Las Vegas casino suite and at gunpoint took back the memorabilia. So it was more than 30 seconds. It was about, maybe 2 minutes and 30 seconds synopsis of those.
That's good. I mean, and let's go back to the double murder. And so we know that the prosecution believes that OJ acted alone, that he did it. And even if let's not hide the elephant in the room here. It's a racially charged case.
OJ's defense played the race card very prominently. Johnny Cochran, brilliant criminal defense attorney, brilliant orator in the courtroom, did what he really should have done if you're being paid to defend O.J. Simpson, which was divert attention from the crime. And on the heels of the Rodney King incident that had happened a couple of years earlier, which was a videotaped beatdown the LAPD gave to a citizen named Rodney King and got huge headlines in the early 90s. In that climate, Johnny Cochran did what he should have done, which is he turned the OJ case and the guilty or not guilty verdict into a referendum on how the LAPD treats African Americans.
Right. So he flipped it so that it ended up being like the LAPD was on trial instead of OJ.
Because it was clear by the evidence that he was guilty, but yeah. Cochran wanted to make sure that nobody was paying attention to the evidence.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to try to, as much as we can here, stick to the organized crime angle. But what I would say is I teach a course on crime and media and we talk about this case. And, if it comes up, I explain to my students, I absolutely think that he did it. Now, was the LAPD corrupt? 100%. Were they racist? 100%. Did they used to plant evidence? 100%. Did they maybe plant evidence in the OJ case? They might have.
Very possibly.
It's very possible. Very possible. So like, I don't deny any of that. I still think he did it. But my overall point is it's complicated. I don't think, it's just the LA cops were corrupt and OJ didn't do it or OJ just did it and Cochran, is sort of a weasel to get him off. I think it's way more complicated than either one of those extreme narratives. Just my thoughts.
Well, I think just like everything, nothing's black and white, and there's always touches of gray in everything. And I think to me, the question of whether he did it or he didn't do it, or whether he did it or whether he was framed, they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
The answers to those questions. Like I firmly believe he did it, and I also semi-firmly believe that the LAPD doctored the investigation as much as they could to jam him up. And just like a lot of police and the highest levels of law enforcement, there's a lot of mental gymnastics that are done by these, big-time superstar cops where they convince themselves that, the
ends justify the means.
Justify the means.
Yeah. When students ask me, do you think OJ did it or was he framed by the FBI? With apologies to the FBI, LAPD, my answer is always yes. Right. I think it's complicated. But there are some alternative theories, right? But when you look at like public opinion polls, certainly most Caucasians believe that OJ did it. But even my understanding is that contemporary polling of African-Americans, I think it's around 50-50. It continues to go up even among African-Americans who think that OJ did it. But there are these alternative theories out there. And some of those were put out by OJ from the beginning and his defense teams. And isn't this really where we're going with this, is like some of the alternative theories that either OJ didn't do it at all, or OJ did it, but he wasn't alone and he may have had some criminal accomplices, or at least people that knew about what happened. So I think that's the point of departure here. So this specific theory that you wrote about is not that OJ didn't do it, right? That's not what's being claimed.
Right.
It's not that it was a Colombian drug hit squad, which was, remember, that was one of the stories that OJ put out back in the 90s, yeah. Remember? So Nicole owed money to Colombian drug dealers and they went and, she didn't have the money. And so they killed her and her friend. That's not what this is. This is something different. So walk us through this specific theory.
So this was actually news that was broken by the Miami New Times. They had it on the front page or front cover of their September magazine. Full disclosure, the story had been shot to me in the last year. And the way it was shot to me, I didn't feel comfortable breaking that news or writing that story. But once it was broken by that publication in Miami a couple weeks ago, I was more than willing to jump on board and throw in my two cents and try to color up that theory as much as I could from, you know, from the space and perspective that I come from. So the theory that's being put forth now comes from a screenplay, Hollywood movie script that was being circulated in a certain entertainment industry circles over the last 5 years ish. And the script is called Juiced, and it tells the story of someone that is being identified as this New Jersey mob associate by the name of Charles Ehrlich, who goes by the nickname Charlie Tuna. And Ehrlich has been on the Fed's radar dating back to the 80s. He took a big drug bust, did some time in prison, came out and has kind of reinvented himself as a South Beach personality. He helps manage and run Dean's Gold strip club on Biscayne Boulevard, and he's been doing that for a good 30 years. He was a co-defendant of O.J. Simpson in the 2007 arrest for the stick up in Las Vegas. And he, along with, he helped a screenwriter write a story based on his life, which appears to implicate himself in being present at the Brown Simpson Goldman double murder. And he posits the theory that the whole reason OJ went over there in the first place wasn't in some type of jealous rage, but was because Nicole Brown Simpson owed a substantial cocaine debt to this New Jersey mob figure that Charlie Tuna was a collector for, the mob figures named Joey Ippolito, who was a made member of the DeKalb-Conte crime family in New Jersey, the real life Sopranos, if you will, and started to make inroads in L.A. In the 80s. And the theory that put forth in the screenplay is that that was what brought O.J. to the house that night. And when either he started to have a conversation with Brown Simpson over the drug bet, it erupted into him murdering her and then murdering Goldman, who had, again, was just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, bringing a pair of glasses that Brown Simpson's mother had left at the dinner that night, bringing them over there to return them, and just happened to get caught in the crosshairs.
So let's back up. So let's make sure that we can establish that these guys are who they say they were before we, you know, break down whether or not there's any truth to this. So Charlie Tuna, it seems like there's no question he was a connected guy, right? Like, that's well established. That's not this isn't bullshit by him saying, "Oh, I used to be connected guy." Like, that's well established. Am I correct?
Yes, and his dad, he's a Jewish mob figure, or alleged mob figure. His dad was part of the Meyer Lansky's group in New York, New Jersey, and Florida back in the 50s and 60s. And Ehrlich was a true blue mobster that got caught dealing cocaine at a pretty major level and had to go do some prison time. It was running around with, you know, the DeKalb-Conte crime family, members of the Lucchese crime family, members of the Genovese crime family. So, yeah, he definitely had a pedigree.
And so between his father and where he grew up, he was around the life as a Jewish wise guy, or I would say Jewish mobster. So that part seems legit, at least, that this dude that OJ was running with was a guy who was connected to some heavyweights. What about Ippolito? He was for sure, a soldado, soldier in the DeKalb-Conte?
Yeah, soldier in the DeKalb-Conte crime family. Came from, you know, I think a multi-generational OC bloodline. Expanded, like a lot of younger mob figures in the 80s that were, you know, jumping into the booming cocaine game. A lot of those guys started to, you know, span out of the East Coast, down south, out west. Ippolito was doing a lot of things in South Beach and Miami when that area started to really pop off, and then was also had a lot of activity going on in LA, even opened his own restaurant in Malibu. So Ippolito would eventually get brought down in a big LA mob sting, or a federal LA mob sting called Operation Lisma, which stood for Operation LA Sicilian Mafia.
Yeah, I'd really like to know more about that. I mean, I haven't been able to find anything like court documents or anything. Do you have anything on that, like that you can share with me?
Yeah, because the case dovetailed with a couple other things that I've written about. First, it dovetailed with Ronnie Lorenzo, who was his co-defendant in that case. Ronnie Lorenzo's best friends with Jimmy Khan, aka Sonny Corleone.
Right.
Lorenzo has been bailed out and bonded out a number of arrests, I believe, from James Caan. James Caan, you know, vouched for him at parole hearings. And
was he the Colombo guy? What was his affiliation?
Ronnie Lorenzo, I believe, was a Bonanno guy.
Oh, Bonanno, okay.
But James Caan has a very close relationship with the Colombos.
Yeah, that's right.
I believe that he considers himself a I use the words with quotes, but considers himself a disciple of Andy Mush Russo.
Oh, right.
The Godfather.
Right, okay. Yeah.
There's a famous FBI surveillance photo of James Caan and Andy Mush coming out of either a funeral or a wedding.
Yeah, and then and they were known to frequent like Little Italy, right? Like have like very conspicuous dinners in Little Italy, as if I recall.
And that bust was ignited by the undercover work of this FBI agent that had actually gone to film school on the FBI's budget and was able to infiltrate certain mob crews in LA by pretending that he was a film producer looking to make mob movies.
And so these were East Coast guys operating in LA, not connected to the Dragna crime family.
I don't know who was getting what piece of what. I'm thinking to myself at that time period, late 80s, early 90s, that the LA Mafia was still enough of a functioning entity where they were seeing some piece of what was going on.
Sure, that makes sense.
But I don't know for sure. I don't know.
So, but we know that East Coast guys were operating on the West Coast. That's totally established. This guy gets, this guy takes a case. So we know this guy is the real deal, real mafioso from the East Coast. He was operating in LA. Now, do we have any evidence that he was selling dope to Nicole, or is his relationship only through Charlie Tuna?
Yeah. So we only know that through the allegations that were being made in that screenplay by Charlie Ehrlich. Let's also just state for the record that Ehrlich is disassociating himself in some capacity from that screenplay, saying that one of the reasons it never got off the ground was because the screenwriter that he paid to write this and whose name is on it took too many creative liberties with his connection to the Simpson case. So let's just state that right off the bat. And Ehrlich is pretty adamant that he had nothing to do with the Simpson, the Brown Simpson Goldman murders, and wasn't present, despite what the screenplay might lead you to believe.
But isn't there another indirect tie between Ippolito and OJ through AC?
Yeah.
You want to tell us about that?
So although the only thing that right now ties a drug debt between Brown Simpson and Ippolito is what Charlie Ehrlich is telling everyone. What isn't only coming from Ehrlich, which we can see from the Operation LISMA documents and records from that case, is that Al Cowlings, O.J. Simpson's childhood best friend, who was a blocker for him on the offensive line in high school, in Oakland, in college, at USC, and then in the pros with Buffalo. So really his closest friend in terms of a player and someone that he grew up with. AC was a driver and bodyguard for Joey Ippolito when Ippolito would come into LA. And the FBI and DEA have a number of surveillance photos and FBI, DEA wiretaps that document this relationship. And Collins himself, I believe, has been somewhat open about his friendship with Ippolito. And these documents from that particular investigation also connect, you know, at least in terms of a socializing aspect, connects Ippolito to Simpson.
And I would imagine if Ippolito was running with AC, I would imagine that Ippolito and OJ knew each other at the very least.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that investigation showed you that Ippolito was having meals with OJ.
Okay, so that okay, so 100% then. So what was Ippolito? I mean, how did he hook up with AC? Do we know? Was this?
I don't know that.
That's interesting. Maybe it was through some of those Buffalo Wise guys. I don't know that AC and OJ were running with in the '70s. I don't know.
Yeah.
So then, what happens to Ippolito? Because his story also takes an interesting turn.
So Ippolito gets nailed in that case, ended up kind of, I don't know if he escaped or if he was allowed to walk free. It was actually in the weeks before the Brown Simpson Goldman Slanes kind of disappeared. No one knew for sure what was going on, whether or not he was cooperating, whether or not he was being, whether or not he had cut a deal for himself to testify later on, or whether or not he was being let out because he was wearing a wire. Nobody knew for sure. Eventually, it became public knowledge that he had flipped and cut a deal with the government. The mob tried to kill his brother in the December of 97, around Christmas 97. They tried to kill his brother as a deterrent. And then eventually he died in witness protection.
Yeah, it's interesting. The I think it was a guy, an associate from the DeCavalcante family, who tried to kill the brother Sam Ippolito, and apparently, from the story I'm reading, he shot Ippolito twice in the face with a .38, and then ran him over with a car, and somehow the guy survived. So it's a pretty remarkable story. So, but again, so there's no question that Ippolito was a mafia guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, really the only change in the narrative I guess there's two things that are being changed. One, that he possibly had a accomplice, OJ. And two, the reason he went over there. One thing that lends credence to the accomplice theory is that in OJ's very controversial manuscript for a book that never was released called If I Did It, he names, quote unquote, Charlie as someone that he brought with him to do what he said he would have done if he had done it.
Right. Yep. And so I'm not like an OJ sleuth. Like I wasn't like obsessed with the case like others. Has anyone tried to deconstruct or like uncode like or decode like who Charlie is supposed to be? Is anyone else thrown out there that like this was one of these Wise guys that he was running with?
Charlie himself, by putting that screenplay out for sale.
Okay, so he's kind of owning it.
I mean, he's advertised. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to start, you know, getting into territory where Charlie himself can take umbrage with what we're saying. We're just trying to relay the situation at hand. But what's clear, whether or not Charlie signed off on certain specifics of that screenplay, because just to be clear, his name is not on the screenplay. It's his life story being told by someone else writing the screenplay. And he now is trying to distance himself, saying that he took a lot of too much liberty with facts and manipulated did too much dramatic license and made me look like I'm an accomplice to murder.
Right. And we could understand why he would try to distance himself from that.
Right. But I will say that, how that theory got legs was by, you could say, by his own volition, by circulating a script that is called Juiced, based, you know, on OJ's nickname, and which talks about being with him the night that this all happened.
Now, again, I haven't read the book. I'm not an expert on the OJ case. I mean, I studied from sort of an academic, like the spectacle of it, but not the actual like forensics of it. So in his book, if I did it, does OJ say that the person was a driver and that they knew that OJ was going to kill them, or were they just a driver and then OJ comes running out and is like, yeah, I just killed two fucking people. Let's get out of here. Do you know the details?
I grabbed Charlie and brought him with me. And then I blacked out before there was any blood spilled. And then I came to, and there was all this blood, and I gave the clothes to Charlie, and I told him, get rid of it. Something along those lines. I didn't read the manuscript. I'm just based on reportings of other people that have read it.
So here's what I would say, because we're getting short on time here. What I would say, and see if you think this, I don't think any wise guy, a Jewish wise guy, Italian wise guy, regardless, in their right mind, would get in a car with OJ if OJ said, you know what, I'm going to go chop my wife's head off and her friend, and I want you to be the driver and help me get rid of the evidence. I don't think any wise guy in their right mind is going for him for that ride. What do you say to that?
Right. Yes, I agree.
That doesn't add up to me. Now, and then if you could say, well, maybe they didn't know and they were just driving with him. Well, yeah, but if he shows up to the house and he has a ski mask on and black gloves and a huge fucking knife, I suspect a wise guy would be like, okay, something weird is about to happen here. I don't like this. So I'm not buying that aspect of the story. What do you say?
I don't know. What's fact and what's fiction, and so much of the OJ mythology, just... I don't know. I doubt that there's a ton of truth to it, but I do know that there is some truth to some of the things that is some of the things that are part of that theory. Like I personally have no doubt that Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Faye Resnick had accrued cocaine debts.
I agree with you.
I'm talking to people that were around that social scene and people that are OJ case sleuths. Both OJ and Nicole Brown were more than just social cocaine users.
Yeah, but even so, and I agree that seems very likely, I would still say that I just don't think they go after her first. I think they know he's the source of income. They somehow go to him, you know what I mean? Like just to show up and slice her head off, I just don't.
Yeah, I think, again, I want to just clarify. I want to clarify and just make sure that people understand. I don't believe that Charlie Ehrlich is saying that he did anything.
Yes, right.
I think Charlie Ehrlich is saying that the reason that OJ went over that night and the reason I went with him, if you're going to believe the screenplay, was to collect a drug debt for Joey Ippolito. And that reason led to what happened. I don't think they're saying that, like, Ippolito put a hit out on Nicole
Brown. Right.
That's not what's being said.
Yeah, that makes sense to clarify that. So, who knows? Maybe, again, maybe there's a mix of truth and lies here. I mean, maybe, I'm just throwing this out there. Maybe OJ told people that that's what he was going over there for, when in fact OJ was, it was premeditated murder. Like, OJ knew that that's what he was going over there for. But if it came up to someone else, maybe he came up with a story. Like, oh, I have to, because she was affiliated with these drug dealers and had a drug debt. Maybe that was a cover story he used, because, you know, he's probably not going to tell anyone, I'm about to go over there and kill her. And if someone else shows up and gets in my way, I'll kill them too. So there may be a little bit of truth to it, but I still think that he did it was premeditated. And I'm not sure if anyone was along with him for the ride in any capacity at all. There's just not enough evidence, I don't think.
And I don't think if you really were there, you would write a screenplay about it.
Yes, good point.
There's a possibility that you weren't and you want to sell a screenplay, so you interject yourself in it.
Yeah.
In the same way that Frank Sheeran interjects himself into the Hoffa mythology.
Right, that's a good parallel. Yeah, and I think that's probably the most astute comment of the night is right. Like,
especially if you know you didn't do it, and there's no way they can pin it on you.
Yeah, why throw yourself in there?
Brag about it.
Right.
No, I'm saying then you can't brag about it because you know.
Oh yeah,
you're only doing
what
it for street cred.
Yes. Yes.
There's no way they can actually nail you on.
Yes, because there's no right. There's no nothing to it. So, well, anyhow, it's a fascinating story, and it's interesting that O.J. Simpson is still, you know, a hot topic, and even to the extent that the original Gangsters podcast, even we found an excuse to break down the O.J. Simpson case. We found if there was an organized crime angle, Bernie was gonna find it and bring it to our attention. So we appreciate that. It's a really fun story. I mean, tragic. I don't want people to think I think a double homicide is fun. That's not. But let's be honest. Like OJ, the whole OJ phenomenon has gone beyond the double homicide. Like it's just its own thing. You know what I mean?
It's an indelible part of culture of the late 20th century when James and I were coming up as young pups. I know it's something that I mark time from. I mean, I remember where I was the night that the chase occurred. I remember coming back from a basketball game that I had played in the summer league and going to a friend's house to watch the NBA finals between Patrick Ewing and Hakeem Olajuwon. And the next thing you know, we're watching O.J. Simpson, on national television, telling the LAPD that he's going to blow his head off in the middle of the freeway with cameras from around the globe watching. I mean, it was surreal.
Yeah, and there was it seems like today everything's a spectacle with social media and whatnot. But back then, I try to explain to my students, like, if you weren't there, it's impossible for you to understand what that environment was like, that media environment, because we had never witnessed anything like that. Any spectacle to that, media spectacle to that scale, I don't think so.
Just imagine before social media, every single person in America, I mean, it's an exaggeration, but practically the whole country was all watching the same thing, and it wasn't the Super Bowl, and it wasn't the Oscars.
No, listen, how about this? When I was, at a university, when the verdict was read, the whole university shut down. And for you younger listeners, there was no smartphones, no laptops. It was people had radios and little fucking black and white TVs, and the whole campus shut down because they knew nobody was going to class. No one. And so, like, can you imagine something like that? I mean, grabbing the university's attention like that, shutting down a whole campus other than, like, some kind of civil strife or something like that? I can't imagine anything, like, grabbing the nation's attention like that.
Yeah, it went viral before anything we ever knew the term viral.
Good way to put it. Yeah, good way to put it. So, and by the way, I also remember, just since we're talking about it as a popular culture phenomenon, how like comedy shifted. Like at first, like I remember Howard Stern was one of the first people to find elements of the case funny. And like, he took some slack at first, like, well, it's a double homicide. You shouldn't be joking about it, but look, they all jumped on it. Right. Not long after that, Leno, Letterman, like not long after
it was every single monologue
Saturday Night Live
for 2 years.
Right.
Had an OJ joke.
Yeah. I mean, SNL would parody. I mean, it became like the butt of a joke.
Norm MacDonald, who just died, the RIP Norm, he got fired from SNL for doing too many OJ jokes because Don Ohlmeyer, who was running the network at that time, was really close friends with OJ.
Yeah, so there's just so many threads to this story. It's the gift that keeps on giving, so to speak. Whether you're a true crime, geek or interested in from the organized crime angle, or just as like someone who studies popular culture, there's just so much there's so much material to work with. So anyhow, I would say to everyone, thanks for listening. Thanks, Bernie, for calling in. I know next week you'll be back in studio with us. And just want to make sure we give a shout out to our social media at Gangster Podcast. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Please follow us and spread the word. The audience is growing. We can see from the analytics that the audience is growing. We've got some things in the works. I know it's taking some time, and we appreciate your patience, but we're working on some things, trying to get some video content and some other things going. So keep your eyes and ears open.
I got a big guest that I have not locked down yet. I'm not going to give the name away, but is, I want to say, 90% locked down. And this was a major, major OC figure.
Nice.
That has never really done a public interview before. So hopefully it could be appearing on the OG podcast in the next week or two.
Nice. Perfect tease.
Keep yourself up to date, and we'll tease it out a little bit more the closer we get to locking this down. But I'm hoping to have this locked down the next couple of days. But it's a guy I've talked to on the phone before. We've discussed maybe doing a book. Never happened. I didn't have time. I had the time issues. But this guy definitely has a story to tell. I'll just say that he was a high-ranking member of one of the five families, and in the heyday.
Wow! What a nice tease. And by the way, today I also met someone who was Whitey Bulger's neighbor in Santa Monica, and we're going to try to get this person on our podcast too. So we got some really interesting things coming up. So anyhow, thanks for listening. I'm Jimmy Bucciolato and Scott Bernstein signing off.
Yeah, thanks for dealing with my call-in situation. I appreciate you. I'll be back in the studio, and thanks to Jimmy and Mark for holding it down at ground zero for the OG podcast.
Yep. Thanks. See you guys next week.